You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, political reporter Dave Weigel from the Washington Post on Superb Tuesday. Super Tuesday. Whatever. Yesterday. The results are in. Trump wins big, but not super, super big. Sort of supra big. No. Mildly superly big. Just enough to keep, like, them all in that sort of the shotgun seat of denial. I have to say, could not have been a better result from my estimation, at least on the Republican side.
Existentially, aren't we all in the shotgun seat of denial?
Indeed.
That's a good
indeed.
Line.
Indeed. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, tough night for Bernie Sanders. Not hugely surprising. He won Colorado, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Vermont. Three of those were caucuses. I don't know, actually. Oklahoma was not a caucus. So Oklahoma, a good win. Would have been nice to have won Massachusetts if you were a Bernie Sanders fan. If you're a Hillary Clinton fan, you're right on track. But the terrain is going to change in the next couple of weeks. We'll ask Dave Weigel whether or not he thinks Sanders is in a position to exploit that change in terrain. Meanwhile, here's the big question from last night on the Republican side. Is Donald Trump's vote anti-establishment or just mostly racist? And I'm using racist as a shorthand for xenophobic, nationalist.
Racist.
And racist.
You're using racist as a shorthand for racist.
Yeah. Meanwhile, six New Jersey newspapers call on Chris Christie to resign the governorship, and I call on him to become Donald Trump's butler. Just go full hog. He practiced it last night, and it seemed to me he was doing a great job as Trump's butler. He sat in front of a podium. I'll tell you, that Trump... The Trump press conference, and he held a press conference that looked like, well, it looked like a presidential press conference, the way they had the flag set up and whatnot. I mean, it was really done very self-consciously, I think, the mise-en-scene. But the difference was Chris Christie, who introduced him, I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen this, A, with a surrogate period, that they then... sort of after they've introduced Il Duce, they step back 2 feet and to the right. You know what? The only place, honestly, the only time you see something like this, I mean, that I can recall is like Maybe this is the first thing that came to my mind. It's like the Nation of Islam. Like where you see like a speaker come up and then like there'll be, you know, someone who looks like if Chris Christie did not look like he hasn't exercised in a long time, I would think that's a security guard or something.
I'm going to do a fantastic job as the leader of the nation.
But Chris Christie, we don't have any video of this, do we? We can maybe just drop some in or something because there's no sound here. It's just Donald Trump talking.
He does look miserable.
And Chris Christie, it's not that he just looks miserable. I mean, at one point, it looks like he's hypnotized by the back of Donald Trump's head. Like, it's almost as if he sees something in, like, Donald Trump's head. Like, he's thinking, like, is that a seam I see? Or something. It's like, I don't know. You know, at one point, I was thinking that he was thinking, like, okay, is this... He's just sort of weighing the idea of this humiliation versus the idea of an indictment. But he had a very, very odd look on his head. But also, it was just a very weird place for him to stand. Like, why was he there the whole time? I think it must have been Trump said, stand there. I honestly, I can't imagine they got together. And it was so weird because Christie seemed to be so lost because he probably has not been put in that position since he was a U.S. attorney. You know, when... I don't know, Eagle Soar. I can't even remember his name now. Ashcroft. When Ashcroft got up there to announce something to announce a case, that's what also, this is the other thing it reminds you of, where you have like a commissioner or a Department of Justice comes out to make the big announcement and then they bring up the subordinate to speak. But this was the opposite. And so I don't know that he's been in that sort of like heel position, literally heel. Like that's the way you treat, it's the way you train your dog, right? You stand there and you just train your dog to step, to be two steps behind you. That's what that guy Cesar, what's his face, told me when he was on the show 10 years ago. And it was very, very strange. But Trump is already moving. I think I said this yesterday on the program. Was it yesterday? Yeah. That Hillary is going to have to move to her left. Bernie may drive her there in terms of economic populism, but she's going to have to move there because of Trump. Trump already made that pivot last night. In fact, Ted Cruz was talking like that too. Trump is already eyeing, and part of it, of course, they're both talking that way because they know that next week they head to places like Michigan, Ohio, Illinois. So their rhetoric turns more rust belty, if you will. So this is what we're going to see. This Saturday we have some caucuses, Louisiana votes. Then there's like some splits, Maine Republican caucus, Nebraska Democratic caucus. But March 8th, Michigan. And then, of course, March 12th, I should say March 15th, Illinois, in addition to Florida, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio. Those are big states. So we'll get to Dave Weigel in a minute. But let me ask you this, folks. Do you love books but find you never have the time to read them like me? Well, Audible.com has the perfect solution. Get audiobooks and listen to those books you've been meaning to read while on the go, at the gym, during your commute, when you're trying to avoid your family. Audible.com provides over 180,000 titles from leading audiobook publishers and broadcasters, entertainers. They got like stand-up, magazines, newspapers, business information providers. Their app is free. It works on iPhones, iPads, Android, Windows phones. You can also download and listen on your Kindle Fire. Over 500 MP3 players. And unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. So you can access your books anytime you want. anywhere right from your smartphone. Audible.com has the great listen guarantee. If you decide you don't like the book you choose, no worries. You can exchange any book that you aren't happy with for another title anytime, no questions asked. Now, Matt here in the office has been an Audible listener since, like, what? You were, like, 12?
2011, I think.
And you used to listen on your Zune, right? I mean, didn't you have a modified Zune that you used to listen to this?
No, I had an iPod Mini.
iPod Mini? Weren't you using, what was that? What was that first?
The Microsoft
Apple
one?
No, the first Apple. Newton. You used to listen on your Newton, didn't you? You didn't even know what I'm talking about. Matt, how many books do you think you've listened to on Audible.com?
I think I own like 150 or so.
And how many do you think you've listened to? 150?
Probably most of them, yeah.
Crazy. I mean, that's great. And just for our listeners, Audible.com offering a 30-day free trial membership. You're not eligible, Matt. You've already had it. Go to audible.com/majority today to start your free trial. Again, show your support for the Majority Report. Get a free 30-day trial at audible.com/majority. Take a quick break. Going to go to Dave Weigel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program political reporter for The Washington Post, Dave Weigel. Dave, I don't know how you're still standing. I mean, this has been a relentless primary season, and you are, I mean, you have the schedule of like a candidate. More.
I try. I've had a good time, frankly. The only question is, at this point, is what I'm able to cover in person and what I just have to opine about from afar. And there's a lot of the first category and not much of the second. And what I keep telling people who have lives and kids is that I don't have those things, so I can go anywhere.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it, and the reporting has been great. All right, so let's start with this. What was last night? Trump won. I mean, I think you characterize it as he won. It was almost a blowout, but almost a blowout for Trump. What? Tell us what was you found surprising last night on the Republican side, anyway.
I guess surprising is a good way to phrase it, because as an election nerd, which I hope you and listeners are, I've been frustrated with how the media covers this. There is this sort of sense that the big states on the map are all equal, and like they're each pogs that you're collecting, and whoever gets the most pogs wins. And so there was really kind of a silly narrative beforehand, and I saw some of this while covering it, that one, Donald Trump might sweep every state, which no one seriously thought could happen. Two, that Ted Cruz might lose Texas, which again no one thought would happen. And it didn't take a lot of work if you talk to people in Texas. They had early voting. There was just a lot of people voting for Ted Cruz before the race looked like it was closing. So I wasn't surprised by this at all. I guess the one state I'd covered personally that made me, I basically confess I went to sleep and woke up with this result, was Alaska, where early on Rand Paul targeted that state when I was covering him, and Marco Rubio hired a very smart strategist who helped elect the Bush family several times, or helped get them through that caucus several times. And Cruz won. I believe Rubio fell to third place. This is a very low turnout event. It's the kind of thing where you think the muscle of a good strategist might do it for Rubio. And that was one that surprised me and said, man, like, you just are not seeing Republican voters fall in love with the guy the way they need.
Well, let's talk about Rubio for a minute, because one of the things, it's not only have the voters not responded to the guy. I mean, my sense has always been that, you know, he's just too closely associated with immigration reform, fairly or unfairly. I think fairly, at least from their perspective. But why do you think that it seemed to me that when Bush dropped out, or, you know, just in the days leading up to it, that there would have been a big rush to Rubio in terms of cash and whatnot. And I feel like that never seemed to have materialized. Is there a sense, at least amongst the donor class or the establishment, that there's something toxic about Rubio? Or was it, I mean, why couldn't they coalesce around him?
There are rumors about him stemming from just Florida political reporting and from the vetting that Mitt Romney did in 2012. There are rumors that I can't repeat because I haven't done any more, less of the rumors, more than I haven't checked them out at all. I don't think, and you'll fear that here's the first reason. Like, do we know enough about this guy? We knew everything about Jeb Bush. I think it's it's simpler than that. One, he's just not showing the evidence that he knows how to win over voters in this age of kind of slow growing economy and economic angst. He's really not. And I think it comes down to this. I like the way Matt Iglesias put it at Vox, which is that Trump is appealing directly to those voters who have felt alienated by 8 years of Obama and, to an extent, 8 years of George Bush, right? And Rubio's leaning into it, saying, well, you know, they won the culture war. We're going to go along with that. We should go with the cool guy who listens to rap and, you know, thinks that the gay marriage fight's basically over, but we can whine about it a bit more. It's just like this very safe suburban version of what seems electable that is not inspiring any passion. The question of why donors wouldn't be impressed by that, I think it's a combination of we don't know who this guy is and a sense that he just, like, the guy needs to put more on the board. I mean, the only thing you can win is this Minnesota caucus, which you bragged about being able to win for 6 months, and some Virginia suburbs where liberals are voting for you out of pity. What is the proof that you actually can break through here? He's kind of copying the parts of the Obama phenomenon that didn't work and not living up to the parts that did.
All right, I just want to clarify something. When you say in Virginia he won because liberals fell pity on you, I mean, Peter Beinart had a piece calling on liberals to go vote for Rubio, cross over. Are you suggesting that that's what happened in Virginia?
Well, that wasn't all of it, but I definitely talked to, well, not even talked to, so I put out a call on Twitter for people who were doing that to tell me why. Before that, I had three friends who are smart journalists who wrote about it on Facebook. You know, Jason Lincoln's Huffington Post is one of them, who said they were doing it too. And anecdote is not data, but I just knew, if you know personally, people in your circle of friends who are doing this, you figure some of it's happening. And maybe, let's say there were 2,000 or 3,000 liberal votes for him in the suburbs there. That's not going to happen in every state. Now, I can see if there's a deep terror of Trump, more of that happening elsewhere, but the problem was Rubio got to this point after the last few primaries where the media coverage was of him as the Trump stopper. He doesn't look like that right now. And again, I think some of that is because of the silly way the media covers this. I mean, anyone who believes that Super Tuesday was good for Cruz because he won Texas should just Google what he said about Super Tuesday a month ago. He was saying he was going to win the entire South. He won just the part of it that he lives in, and Oklahoma, and then, you know, Wasilla. He won those things. But I think you're going to, without the coverage of Rubio as the natural Trump slayer, I don't know what the motivation is for these people go in the next primaries. Let's say Michigan comes up. The only thing I think anti-Trump people have going for them when it comes to Democratic votes is I think the coverage, Michigan will probably be the last place where it looks like Bernie Sanders has a fighting chance to beat Hillary. If that does not happen there, then liberals are going to look to the Republican primary and wonder what the heck's happening in their country. In places like Illinois, for example, I can see in Illinois a lot of suburbanites in DuPage County and Cook County saying, "What the hell? We can't let Trump win this state." But they didn't do it for him in Virginia.
Interesting. So so let me ask you this. In terms of, let's say, just Kasich. I mean, because there's this whole theory, right, that these guys are going to drop out at one point. But I don't necessarily, like, look, you're having fun, right? And I don't see where the motivation is for any of these guys. I mean, I think Kasich maybe, you know, after he, apparently he's going to stay in until Ohio gets to vote. And I got to think that after last night, he came close in Vermont. He thinks that he has a real shot. Maybe he does. I don't know. You tell me. But is there a sense go ahead.
Well, I spent 2 days with Kasich in New England, in Vermont. I mean, I saw how he almost won. He basically was the only guy who showed up twice in Vermont. And I looked at the map. He won the places he showed up by a lot. And I talked to his endorsers last night, and their sense is, look, Rubio's a lightweight. Rubio's not – it'd be great if he was the next Obama. It doesn't look like he is. Since he isn't, we need someone like Kasich in the position to hold on and be a consensus nominee at the convention. I mean, Kasich's people more than anyone else talk openly about a Burka convention, right? They – and the sense is, let's give him till Ohio. That's what Kasich says, too. If he manages to win Ohio, then he's still in this. That's I'm kind of being now I'm repeating the same thing you hear in the rest of the media, but it's basically true. There is, unless this is a phrase that I wish I could avoid using, but unless Trump does something to destroy himself, which he keeps not doing, then we really don't have anything definitive happening until the 15th.
So, all right. So let me ask you this. I mean, so all these guys are going to stay in, right? I mean, if Kasich is going to go to they're all going to stay in. There's no way. Or you tell me. I mean, is there a chance that they go to the Republican convention? Trump has, let's say, he's 75% of the way there for delegates. I'm just spitballing here. I don't know the numbers. But is there really a way that they could come out of that convention with supporting Kasich? I mean, that just seems fantastical to me.
Well, so here's the problem that Republicans made for themselves, which you can't not laugh at. How far do I want to go back with it? You can basically blame Ron Paul supporters for this problem. It used to be that you need to win 5 states for someone to put your name in nomination of the convention. And Ron Paul came in very close, got 4. If you remember, they didn't even bother nominating him. But it was close enough that they raised the threshold to 8 states. And right now, I mean, Rubio needs to do a lot better than he's doing to get close to that. Kasich needs to do a lot better than he's doing. Cruz might be kind of on the path. But right now, the rules of the Republican Party say that even if it's brokered to be put into nomination, you need to have more 8 wins. And the number to remember is Rule 40. You have already actually this came up when I was at a Kasich event in Vermont, where somebody who was undecided between him and Trump was asking Kasich if he'd heard of this. The RNC can always just show up in Cleveland and say, this is a stupid rule, we're changing it, and then allow anyone to be nominated. This would need to be done publicly, and people could protest it. But that's when you'll know they're really panicking, if there's an open discussion about whether they created dumb rules for themselves and need to bend them in order to allow somebody who maybe couldn't be pushed through the primary to be nominated.
All right, so
and
wait,
I should say,
reiterate this so that I'm clear. So there's a Rule 40 which says that you need to win 8 states before you can even be considered in nomination. So, and the only way that changes is if when they get there they change the rules, which happens. But I mean, if they change the rules to allow for a John Kasich. Or let's say, I don't know, why hasn't Mitt Romney endorsed anybody?
I was going to say,
I mean,
that's the conspiracy theory. Or I shouldn't even say conspiracy, it's just a theory. It's not really a conspiracy.
That just seems, I mean, let me ask you, doesn't that seem like that's impossible? Like the idea, if they're worried about Donald Trump, the only reason why they would do that is not because they're worried about Donald Trump losing. The only reason why they would do that is if they're afraid that Donald Trump's going to win in the general election.
Both, I think. I mean, the Democratic version of this that I've heard, not from really serious people, but from people, is that maybe Hillary Clinton wins the nomination and then gets indicted 10 ways by over her email or something, and they're panicking and they need to give the nomination to Joe Biden. Like, both parties have a break the glass theory, and it's more about winning the election. I mean, the paradox is, Ruby, I have a Republican friend who supports him but doesn't work for him, and says it's really like watching a horror movie where you can see the like undergrad walking into the closet when the guy has a knife. Like, you can just see, hey, every poll says the 44-year-old Latino guy is our best candidate. What are you guys doing? There's just a belief in the party that if Rubio proves himself, he's their most electable candidate. And this is the problem. He keeps just not proving that. So it is really more about, they're not really worried about, I think they're worried about President Trump losing and about him winning, right? Or Donald Trump becoming President Trump or losing the election. Both of them are frightening for them for different reasons. In one, maybe he is a disastrous president and discredits the party. In the other, then Hillary Clinton is president, and there's a little civil war within the party. Like, they're both horrible options.
I mean, but it seems to me that if they go into the convention, right, and they say, okay, Trump is in the lead, but we're going to rig this thing so that anybody else, Rubio, Kasich, Mitt Romney, maybe Zombie Reagan, but let's just assume they're not able to reanimate him. It seems to me that they're going to have a bloodbath on their hands. I mean, there was a reason, right, why John McCain needed to pick Sarah Palin. He thought he wouldn't be able to get out of the convention, it seems to me. If they were to pick somebody else against Trump, you would lose. It's like I think like you'd have an open revolt of like 25% of the party. I mean,
not just that. You also have a candidate who has said if the party doesn't treat him fairly, he's going to run a third party. Now, that said, he would have to start organizing and getting on ballots a long time before this,
right?
Because just as Ron Paul forced Republicans to inspired Republicans to change their rules, Ross Perot inspired a lot of states to make it hard to be a third party candidate. So he's less of a threat as a third party candidate than as covered, but any threat. I mean, a conservative candidate who takes 10% of the blue collar white vote out of their pocket means maybe a Republican candidate cannot get a victory in Tennessee or something, you know? And they've not really thought of this contingency, or they've thought of it, but it's terrifying to think about, I guess.
All right. So let me ask you this in terms of, I mean, get your sense about, you know, this idea that Trump is an anti-establishment vote. There was a really interesting exit poll I saw out of Georgia. And I got it here in my pack. Let me just see. It was really sort of fascinating to me because there's this sort of, you know, this mainstream narrative that this is about, you know, the party being, you know, having promised stuff and never getting it, you know, the voters never getting it. Well, this is coming out of Georgia. It says, do you feel betrayed by Republican politicians? And Trump voters, 35% said yes, but 44% said no. It's Cruz voters, 27% said yes, and 18% said no. I mean, I guess it's maybe or of the yes voters, as far as I can tell, Trump's not necessarily he's attracting a decent amount of people who are pissed at Republican politicians, but he's attracting even more who are not.
That's a good point. So
what I was saying
before about the economic argument is I don't think enough Republicans have thought whether the very pH tested, litmus tested message of their party is what their voters want. I mean, they look at what happened in 2009-10, for example. They had a Tea Party movement rise up that they are able to pour in a useful direction. They're, hey, thanks for being part of the Tea Party. You all believe what Paul Ryan believes now, don't you? And they kept voting Republican, but it wasn't clear that they actually did believe that. These are people who were more worried about the Affordable Care Act ending Medicare, and they were worried about the national debt in this kind of inchoate way that Republicans are not, because Republicans are not doing anything to reduce the national debt, apart from hoping tax cuts magically solve it. Like, there's just been a disconnect between what Republicans believe when they do act on what they say. And I feel like there are Trump voters who know that. They do not care about politics apart from the sense that both parties have screwed them. I guess we'll use that word because I hear that a lot at Fed rallies. And that's not fixable unless you change what they stand for. And so the thing I'm fascinated by is there is a voter who voted for Huckabee and voted for Santorum. And I still hear the Cruz people say, well, you know, that guy's going to come to us eventually. I'm not so sure, because the Cruz message on economics is I'm going to replace our tax system with something that actually does even worse for you than the current one, right? We're going to have a sales tax, and the rich are going to pay less. And the Trump tax plan is actually super aggressive, but what he focuses on is I'm going to tear up trade deals.
Right.
And I'm going to make sure that you all have health care. Like, there's just this disconnect in the Republican Party that anyone would believe that, but clearly millions of people believe that.
I should just remind people that that Huckabee was an economic populist at the very least. I mean, I think, you know, in 2008, yeah. He sort of tacked away from that as he got in sort of that Fox world a little bit. But he was the one who's talking about protecting Social Security and Medicare. And he was the one who's talking about at least delivering the rhetoric of helping the little guy. And Santorum did the same thing with his sort of manufacturing. I don't think we heard as much about that, or maybe we did this year. I can't remember. I get confused with Santorum, frankly.
I mean, we did, but nobody listened.
But
he wrote a whole book. He's actually, he's the candidate I probably feel most sorry for. I know there's a strange new sorrow people feel for Jeb Bush. I don't really feel that. I feel bad for Santorum, who had basically a Trump economic message and combined it with, you know, with the rest of his politics people didn't like. But he was kind of banging the drum, warning them to do this, and only Trump copied him. So none of these guys have the armament to defeat him.
Now, let me ask you this, too, because, you know, I'm harping on this establishment thing as to whether or not that it's a question of, like, Trump's voters feel in some way sort of betrayed, or just like, you know, because on one hand, a majority of those Trump voters are not, they don't feel betrayed. At least this is Georgia. I don't know if that holds, but Georgia's a pretty red state, I guess. Super Tuesday Republican primaries supports temporarily banning Muslims who are not U.S. citizens from entering the U.S. Alabama, Arkansas, Tennessee is in the 70s. Texas and Virginia in the mid 60s. I mean, if there is, and I saw one, I saw another thing said, like, there's a huge percentage of Trump voters who think Obama is a Muslim. I mean,
right.
You know, we're not talking, we're only talking about whatever it is, 30 or 40%, right, of the Republican Party. Why is it so hard for people to realize, like, this is just, I mean, at the end of the day, the one thing that the majority of those voters just buy into is that, like, the black guy who's running the country is obviously a secret Muslim, and Muslims should be kept out, and that's all just sort of I mean, tell me if I'm being unfair here, that all of that is just a surrogate for, like, don't like the fact that it's a zero-sum game where black people are getting these special privileges. Don't like the fact, frankly, that women are, I mean, when you think about everything that has sort of catapulted Trump at different points, it seems to me it has been, it's not been like my tax plan came out. It's Mexicans are sending rapists. Rosie O'Donnell's a fat pig. You know, I mean, there's a pattern here that just seems to be, you know, sort of largely ignored, where there's sort of like a more acceptable and more appropriate answer here, other than this guy's just, you know, a real a-hole towards anybody who's not sort of like him.
There's a big part of that. He has the contempt for politics and politicians that these voters have always had. And I think this, of all the things that should be terrifying to Rubio people from yesterday, one is that the poor guy, you know, decided to adopt the Trump style, and it just didn't work for him. He just felt like, it felt like he had a focus group with Triumph the Insult comic dog and used what he thought was the most most amusing. And he had conservative intellectuals like Ben Dominic and Bill Kristol. And if you look at conservative Twitter, which has been apoplectic for a couple weeks now, they were all saying, yeah, use this, make fun of him. That's what people want. It just doesn't seem credible to people.
The fascinating thing to me about Trump is every time he says something that is sort of outside of the Republican orthodoxy, which is not necessarily about policy, right? It's more like George Bush was the president on 9/11. We went to war. There was no weapons of mass destruction. When he says stuff like that, all that gets communicated, as far as I can tell, when I talk to people who are thinking about voting for Trump, all that gets communicated is that this guy's saying something that should hurt his chances to win. Therefore, he must be just a straight, honest talker and telling us the truth, even if I disagree with it. So he's a trustful guy because he's not lying to us. So it's like every time he breaks Republican orthodoxy, the meta message is, you can trust me because I wouldn't say this unless I actually believed it, because this is supposedly something that's going to hurt me.
Yeah, this is also the it's not just that, it's that he has said things that all of us in political journalism read as problematic, and they haven't heard him at all. And they read that way, I think, because he's finally said something that no other Republican says, which means it must be earnest. And the Muslim, I think the Muslim ban is the best of these. And I don't gloat about it because it's sad. I definitely remember some liberal journalists I knew who were very smart, assuming that was the moment he went too far.
Right.
And it completely wasn't. It was completely the opposite. It was something that he would say and no one else would say, and everyone else was marble-mouthed about it. I think I'm still not over this yet, the fact that every week we have another reason to pronounce the political genius of Donald Trump. He keeps doing this where he says something that is just makes no sense to the political class that run campaigns, and boom, it turned out it was what people wanted to hear. That's why I thought for the last few weeks, or sorry, the last few days, that the best thing Rubio was doing was calling him a con artist whose entire reputation was based on grift and graft, and he screwed over poor people. They tried that. It didn't work. I still think the latest kind of rose-goggled spin on the primer is, well, maybe we need more time for that to sink in. And you know what? That's not crazy. Like, we have Michigan, where I'm reporting from now, in 6 days. If I were a billionaire and I dumped $5 million of TV ads of people saying Donald Trump ruined their lives in, Oakland County and Wayne County and Western Michigan, if I did that, maybe it would work. Who knows?
That's exactly
the problem was Rubio got sideswiped and decided to waste 2 days on the stupid KKK thing, which no voter care about.
Right. That's the Sheldon Adelson giving, Newt Gingrich round two of his campaign, right? I mean, that is exactly, people say that didn't work. That extended the primary by like 3 months, it seems to me. That whatever it was, 20-minute video that he did. I think a 20-minute video on Trump, done in that same way has a tremendous impact on Trump. Maybe not so much for Rubio at this point, but certainly for the Democrats. So let's turn for a moment to the Democrats. Give me your sense of what's going on here. My understanding is that this was very unfavorable terrain to Bernie Sanders based upon what he's been able to marshal in terms of support within the black community. But going north, when you start getting into the Michigans and the Illinois and the Ohios, it becomes more favorable. Is that your sense, or is there stuff that we should be looking at that suggests that maybe he hasn't, as some people are pointing towards Massachusetts, I guess, is an indication that he's not quite resonating with those folks in the way that one might think he should be.
The story of this has been what I think people saw 6 months ago when he started to pick up steam, which was there have been progressive message candidates before. They have come pretty close or surprised in some states. But they have not won over non-white voters, and that's still his problem. His campaign won Colorado, and that was part to do with those voters, but he My favorite result from last night was Lowell, Massachusetts, which on the surface looks like the sort of town that Hillary got wiped out in New Hampshire. When you think of Lowell, you think of a working class manufacturing town. And it still kind of is, but it's more of a place where refugees and immigrants have moved in.
Yes.
And that was the sort of town that Hillary Clinton won in Massachusetts. I have to go right now. I'm in the middle of a story, but I appreciate talking about it.
All right. Well, Dave, thanks so much for taking the time. I appreciate your spending the time. I know you're incredibly busy and never sleeping. So thanks so much for being on. Dave Weigel.
Thank you.
We'll do it again. Thanks. All right, folks. I mean, interesting take on the on what's happening on the Republican side. It is, I don't know how else to put this. It's a absolute crap show. And I have to admit, I'm really enjoying it. It's true.
Well, that's a fantastic point.
I think, look, I mean, they're all going to go to the convention. I mean, Carson could drop out at one point, though. I'm not even sure why I would drop out. Exactly.
I just started kitchen renovations. I'm making stupid cash money flow.
I mean, on that point.
That's a straw man.
On that point, all right, let's go into majorityreporters@gmail.com. Now, people talk about how, but the last one, let's see. People talk about how Ben Carson got completely hoodwinked by his campaign staff. And they kept selling him just lists and lists and lists. And they're just hitting, they're just not targeting anything. Well, we're on the Carson America Inc. list. And I'm not, when I say that, I'm not mocking him. I'm reading from the email I'm looking at. We got one, let's see. Yeah, now, of course, we get the press ones, right? But we also get just the emails, and this is it, March 1st. This is it. And when in the preview thing, you can say, it says Carson Inc. Sam, this is it. Today is the day. It's Super Tuesday. People are now voting in 12 states. I can't overstate this. We need your last minute help before the polls close. Make a donation of just $12 now. That's $1 for each state voting today. This is our opportunity. We cannot come up short. Thank you, Sam. I'm honored to call you a supporter. Ben. Sent from my iPhone. It's right here. Sent from his iPhone. Holy crap. Really, Ben?
These supporters of mine are a bunch of real archaeologists, if you know what I mean.
On February 29th, Sam, I have a simple but urgent request as we approach Super Tuesday on March 1st. Right now, we don't have the resources we need to compete in all 12 states set to vote. This is our opportunity to break through. I mean, it's a very long thing. But this one's from Ben. This is not from his iPhone. So he must have been at his desk when he wrote that one. So Carson's going to stay in there. You've heard Kasich. I mean, if he wins Ohio, it means nothing other than he's convinced himself he could step in. They're going to change this rule 40 or they're not, but there's nobody, no, you know, these people are going to convince themselves that they will. Rubio is not going to drop out because I don't think Marco Rubio is going to win the governorship in Florida. Maybe he thinks he can, but I imagine the polling's not terribly great there. I mean, he can't even win his own state for the presidential primary. And Cruz, there's no reason for Cruz to drop out, right? This just builds his email list.
Right. Wouldn't you imagine there's also going to be Wilson fatigue, Rick Scott fatigue in Florida as well.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough situation for Rubio by any metric.
So this is going to be fascinating to see as it goes on. Cross the partisan and... I don't know, people that you would, cross the partisan and normal people divide. And let's talk about the Democrats for a moment. Clinton won big with the African-American community again. I mean, we've talked about this, right? This is one of the biggest voting blocks, and they vote like a block. Jews do the same thing. I think Jews may be the only other sort of more consistently, you know, like when Jews vote, it's like 80% vote for one candidate.
Right.
African-Americans, same thing. And so you see results through the South where it's like 80 to 20, 85 to 15, 82 to whatnot. Then we go to Ohio and Michigan. I mean, this is all the same stuff we've been saying, but, the Clinton campaign made a very conscious decision, it seems to me, to say we still are taking Sanders seriously. They're not calling for him to get out of the race. There's none of that that's going on. The Sanders campaign, I think, frankly, it seemed to me that every candidate I saw was a little tired. I think, so it wasn't as rousing
really
of a speech that we've seen with Bernie Sanders. Relatively quick, he gave it after Vermont, which was smart because you're not getting that much by talking about a couple of caucuses that you win. Oklahoma was a big win.
Colorado was something of a win too,
yes,
right?
But a caucus again. And Massachusetts would have been good. That would have been a good one. I don't know how Worcester did, but I imagine that Worcester went for Bernie, but not super big.
I imagine my part of the state went pretty big for Bernie.
Yes.
I think the West and the Cape.
Country.
But yeah, no, country, West and Cape, and then the city and affluent suburbs was what pulled it through for Hillary.
The other point I wanted to make with Weigel, and I'll just do that, and then we'll go into the fun half of the program. This whole notion about Trump's voters being anti-establishment, that may be the case, but I am increasingly thinking that this is not, there may be some of that, but it's not the real thing that is driving them. So, and part of that, part of the evidence I have for that theory is that Trump wins Alabama, right? In Alabama, Senator Richard Shelby, on the banking committee, right? A guy who's been, I don't know, he's been in the Senate for
at least
three or four terms?
At least since the early 90s. At least. And I believe
was he a Democrat?
He was a Democrat.
And then switched to Republican.
After the Gingrich takeover.
Okay. So he's been in office for at least 20, 25 years, at least. This is the guy you would imagine be knocked off. Older guy. I think he's got to be 70s, late 70s, early 80s even, maybe. This is a guy you would imagine in a primary would be in danger if there was this anti-establishment fervor. He's 81, Michael tells me. So this is a guy you would imagine would have real problems. There was a five-way Republican primary, and he got 65% of the vote. And even the second highest person got 28% of the vote. Like even the challengers, you need 50%. It would have gone to a runoff. So I mean, if he gets 51%, okay, you'd see some of that. If he gets less, obviously there's even more of that. But to win 65% of that vote for an 81-year-old chairman of the banking committee, and we're supposed to believe there's some type of like anti-establishment fervor in the Republican Party? No, I think they're just attracted to, here's a guy who's just like full-on nativist racist. Or as we call it, anti-PC. And willing to protect religious liberty, even if he's not religious himself.
And people who look at the content of people's character, not their skin color.
That's right. He doesn't care what color you are. If you sweat too much, you're out, buddy.
I have to say, you know, Jeff Sessions, who endorsed Trump, which is, again, is absolutely no surprise. And to and it was interesting. Sessions, he's a major anti-immigrant senator, also very opposed to TPP, and mentioned, quote-unquote, Obama trade when he endorsed Trump. You almost felt this sort of, like, palpable sense of almost jealousy and envy and opportunity, because it was like, I wish I could have been saying this stuff for decades. Like, I thought I had to pretend that I was really racist, and apparently it's just a-okay with Mr. Trump, so I couldn't be more excited.
Hell, man, if I've been talking this whole way, I'd be president four times over by now.
Yeah. Whatever. We'd have the Confederate right up there on the White House.
I mean, nobody seems to be making the point that Donald Trump, the anti-establishment he's in the anti-establishment lane. He's got his consigliere right behind him, the guy who hugged Barack Obama. Right? I mean, wasn't Christie
darling of the media establishment? And I mean, you could not go anywhere and not get a glowing profile of this guy in 2010, right. 2011, 2012. It was disgusting.
But I mean, have you seen a single? I mean, maybe we can have our resident Trump expert call in. He's not going to care that he's embraced by the establishment. Now, maybe to a certain extent, it's like Trump bringing the establishment to heel in some way. But I don't think that's what it is. I think they're just triggered by, like, this dude, he's willing to say it. And he's also a billionaire.
I mean, yeah.
I think the anti-establishment thing, and, you know, I mean, I was talking about this with the Young Turks guys last night. Apparently nobody could hear me because our mic feed to them was bad, but nobody told me until afterwards. But they're talking about there's this anti-establishment fervor in the country, and I think there is a, and you know, Hayes wrote a book about this, I don't know, 5 years ago now. I think there is a distrust, or at least not even a distrust necessarily, a complete loss of faith, I should say, which is different than a distrust. I just don't think that people care. You know, it's clear that the establishment doesn't have the power that it had, at least in the Republican Party, where it can be a signifier. But I think that's different than we're voting for this guy because he's anti-establishment. I think they're just voting for him because he's a jerk. On the left, I don't think people are voting for Bernie Sanders because he's anti-establishment. In other words, I'm trying to think of another figure who might be outside of the establishment. I think they like his policies. I mean, it may be, my sense is in the 60s, right? There was this whole notion of drop out of society. Like, we're creating a counterculture. I don't think that's what's happening. I don't think that's what's driving interest in Bernie Sanders, is that he's different. I think it's that they like what he's saying. Like, they are aware it's different. It is different, but it's not that dynamic that is attractive. It is that, yeah, he's actually addressing our problems.
That's the main part of it. Don't you also think, though, to some, because we've talked a lot about the sort of inner outsider versus insider dimension, and it seems to me that there's some element of Bernie's support where this guy Dave Johnson, who was an editor at Al Jazeera, he posted that quote from Occupy Wall Street, that kind of sign, which was like, it was like with a lot of curse words, I don't know if I could say them, but like S is effed up and stuff. Remember that sign? And he basically said, look, on some level, particularly in the Democratic Party or on the liberal side, you sort of get that diagnosis or you don't. And if you get that diagnosis, you're supporting Bernie. And I think that there's some truth to that, because you can't embrace his policy agenda and addressing people's problems the way he wants to address them without some implicit critique of the quote-unquote establishment or whatever you want to call it.
I mean, his message is that this is rigged.
It's rigged,
and presumably
right,
exactly. It's rigged. But I don't think that this is a question of, like, people are saying, like, I don't like the Democratic establishment.
No, they don't like not having healthcare.
I think they're like, you know, I mean, the you know, and they brought up what's Martin O'Malley, and they're like, well, Martin O'Malley had good policy, but people just didn't believe him. I mean, I think that's at the end of the day with Martin O'Malley, I think people just didn't like think that he was doing anything other than being opportunistic.
Well, that's where the insider-outsider thing definitely resonates.
I don't think people had a problem with Martin O'Malley because he was an outsider or an insider. I just think that they didn't.
Literally, as a vehicle, didn't buy it.
Yeah.
Right.
We just don't trust what you're saying.
Right. I mean, I don't know how to what extent you can disconnect that from some of his quote-unquote insider credentials. But I mean, also, I don't know how many people would even know this, but Bernie said the same thing for decades, whereas Martin O'Malley wrote a column in like 2008 with Harold Ford saying we need to have a Democratic Leadership Council agenda. I mean,
it's not right.
That's one friggin' Google search.
I mean, you know, it seemed to me during the 2008 primary, the dynamic really was John Edwards, people were attracted to his message, but there was a substantial amount of people who didn't trust him.
Right.
That he was actually doing this because his record in the Senate sort of suggested that he really didn't buy this stuff. I think to a certain extent, people, to the extent that they had trust issues with everybody, people didn't trust Hillary Clinton because she voted for the war. And people didn't trust Barack Obama because they weren't sure that he was competent. He'd only been a senator for 2 years. People just didn't even know him. I think so much of this comes down to trust. And that's one of the things that, you know, scares me a little bit about the general election. We saw a little show last night from Trump as to, you know, how he's going to go after Hillary Clinton. Look, most people don't follow politics like we do in this room. Or you do who listens to the show. I know that because if most people followed politics like that, our studio would look much nicer. And
Bernie would be president.
You know, I'd have a little upgrade on my wardrobe.
I get you're getting going very, very granular with this one.
Right. Well, my point being that just people, and so people's perceptions of Hillary Clinton are not like ours, not like, you know, people in this audience, broadly speaking. And I'm not saying one way or another.
For good and for ill.
Yeah. I mean, you know, most people who are going to vote in the election, either for or against Hillary Clinton in the primary or if it's in the general, are not going to say, like, I'm a little concerned with, you know, her, you know, with Mark Penn and with some of the hangers-on in, you know, her circles or whatnot. That's my sense. But here is how Trump is now starting to pivot already to the general election. And also, keep in mind, he is also pivoting to those Rust Belt states. In the next week or 2 weeks, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, not sure when Pennsylvania is. I guess Pennsylvania would get a while anyways. Pennsylvania's not until April. So really, he's looking to Illinois, he's looking to Ohio, he's looking to Michigan with this talk about wage stagnation and infrastructure. Let's listen.
I'm going to be a good president for the world, but we have a country that's in big trouble. Our infrastructure is going to hell. Our roads, our highways, our schools, our hospitals, our airports.
I want just to point out that as Donald Trump is saying, our infrastructure is going to hell. He is standing 2 feet in front of somebody who rejected millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of federal funds to build another desperately needed tunnel under the Hudson River from New Jersey to New York, absconded with some of the funds, the preliminary funds, basically to use as a slush fund. So I just needed to point that out. I'm talking about Chris Christie. Good.
I go throughout the world. I mean, you go to Qatar, you go to, who some people say Qatar, but you go to Qatar, you go to any of the, so many places. You go to different places in China, different places in Asia, different places in the Middle East. You look at some of the airports they have. You look at the roadways they have. You look at the transportation systems they have and the trains they have. We're like a third world country. So I'm going to...
I just want to remind you that most of... I don't remember exactly all of the countries he listed there, but all authoritarian regimes in some form or another, right? I just wanted to make that clear. The reason why we don't have those things is because his buddies complain about taxes going towards that. Now, in Qatar, or Qatar, as some people say, they take their oil revenues and a monarch,
A monarch family, and they sit on a giant sovereign wealth fund.
Right, we're going to do this.
And it's also subsidized on free labor as well. So the actual citizens are... It is actually a really high standard of living, but all of these imported indentured servants from South Asia and Africa make everything run, and then you have a sovereign wealth fund.
And on top of that, Trump is going to make those workers pay their own way to get here.
It'll be very good for the world. I'm going to get along with the world. You're going to be very proud of me. Even you will be very proud of me as a president. But we have to rebuild our country. Our country is going to hell, and people don't understand that. And Hillary Clinton doesn't have a clue. She can't do that. She's talking about, one of the things that has really bothered me, I think one of the reasons I have such great support, is that people, you take a look, people in the middle income groups are making less money today, less money than they made 12 years ago. And in her speech, she just said, they're making less money. Well, she's been there with Obama for a long period of time. Why hasn't she done anything about it? Practically everything that she was complaining about, she's picked up what I say. The difference is she's been there for a long period of time. Why haven't they done anything about it? Then you look at her record as Secretary of State. It's abysmal. You look at what's going on with Syria. You look at what's going on with everything. It's a disaster. So we're going to have an interesting period of time. I don't know that she's going to be allowed to run. What she did is a criminal act. If she's allowed to run, I would be very, very surprised. But if she's allowed to run, honestly, it'll be a sad day for this country. Because what she did was wrong. And what she did, let me just tell you. What she did was wrong. And other people have done far less than her. And they paid a very, very big price.
So there he is, very the way he works this stuff in, like, it pains me to say that she has broken. I'm not taking any pleasure in this, but it's going to be a scourge on our country if Senator Clinton is not in his mind apparently indicted in some respects. Me, the guy who plays footsie with the KKK, it's a proud day for America that I get to run. But
I don't know these people. Hillary Clinton, that would be a debacle.
It would be embarrassing. That's what he's saying.
Embarrassing.
It would be a...
whereas he would be a scourge, really strong for the
band. Well, we're going to be proud of him. We're going to be so proud of him.
I'm going to get sick of being proud of him.
You're going to get sick. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.
Setting up the